You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined, as always, by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, how are you?
I'm fine. Like a lot of our co-religionists, I've discovered that a little matzah goes a long way.
And our guest today is Jacob Heilbrun, the editor of the journal The National Interest, and a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council Eurasia Center, and the author of America Last, the Right Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Jacob, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you, Elliot.
In your book, Jacob, you talk about, you start your history of America First with the movement against intervention in World War I with people like H.L. Mencken and George Sylvester Viereck, people who were not only opposed to America's entry into World War I, but positively enamored of Imperial Germany and Kaiser Bill. Can you explain to our listeners and viewers a little bit about what they were arguing when they argued against American intervention?
Well, there is a tradition, of course, a legitimate tradition of opposition to entry into World War I on the left and the right. But what I was looking at were figures like H.L. Mencken and George Sylvester Viereck, both of whom had German heritage, both of whom were contemptuous of American democracy, and both of whom venerated Prussian autocracy and thought that it would serve as a superior model in America to the homegrown democracy that we enjoyed. So their opposite, and Sylvester Viereck, though he's largely been forgotten, was an important figure, both in World War I and on the eve of World War II, was a paid agent of the German government in both instances. I focused on Mencken because he was such a dominant intellectual force, which is why I quoted in Ravelstein, Saul Bellow's last novel, Chick, the narrator, refers to the influence that Mencken exercised upon an entire generation. And of course, Bellow was speaking for himself through the narrator. And what struck me about Mencken was that he was a brilliant satirist, but it wasn't just buffoonery that he was delivering. I went back and looked at his columns before World War I and during World War I. And there was a venomous edge to the columns. His contempt for democracy and the bourgeoisie and the imbecilic impulses in America, it wasn't just a joke to him. He actually believed it. And he was a bargain basement version of Nietzsche. He actually wrote a book on Nietzsche as a young man and absorbed those doctrines. And I think they fueled his intellectual makeup. And I saw Mencken as the progenitor in many ways of what we today call the old right or paleoconservatism. And Mencken fired the initial shot of revisionism before the United States had even entered World War I. He was arguing, he made all the arguments that you hear today about Russia and Ukraine, that in fact, Germany was the embattled power, that the democracies had ganged up and encircled Germany, that they were had entertained predatory designs upon it. And Sylvester Viereck, in his journal, The Fatherland, disseminated what we would today call misinformation about the war. So Mencken sets the stage for a wave of revisionism about World War I that takes off with the disappointment over Wilson and the Treaty of Versailles.
So, you know, I first, I should just stipulate that, like Eric, I enjoyed the book a lot. Again, there were some familiar figures, but there's a lot of new detail. And I thought it was particularly interesting to start with Mencken, given that he is still sort of, not a revered figure, but he is a figure that gets invoked by a certain kind of writer. What I wanted to ask you about, though, is specifically that where you said this is sort of the paleoconservatives. And, you know, I understand this is mainly a book about foreign policy or attitudes towards foreign policy. But, you know, some people would say, well, you really have to go back and look at the South and sort of the Lost Cause and some of those writers who were, I mean, a weird kind of internationalist, that they wanted to take Cuba and, turn it into another slave republic. But I'm curious about why start there rather than earlier, or do you think there's really a distinction? I did want to make just also a parenthetic remark. I think there's a very important point that you're making, which I hadn't thought about before I read the book, which is that the revisionist view of World War I sets in very, very fast, and it exercises a profound effect. I mean, I just remember talking to my grandfather, who was quite a sophisticated man, and he had a copy of Harry Elmer Barnes, you know, and he believed that stuff, and it is striking to me. And you know, I don't know if this is because Theodore Roosevelt died too young to push back at it or something, but that's very striking. In any case, if you could talk a little bit about Mencken, you know, what connections, if any, do you think there are to this older? I don't know whether it's even. I don't view it as conservative. I think it's more kind of reactionary or anti-liberal or illiberal or anti-democratic tradition.
Yeah, I definitely. Mencken himself. There are some ties, intellectual ties. Mencken himself believed that America's one chance to become a true aristocracy had been in the antebellum South, and that the Civil War ended any aspirations that America might have had to become something on the lines of Periclean Athens. He saw this as a decisive moment in American history. Probably also because, let's face it, he was a racist, anti-democratic, anti-Semitic. I landed on World War I because the fixation with a foreign power seemed so stark there. To choose Prussian autocracy over England, Edwardian England, seemed quite a stark choice to me. And then you also had the fact that what's been almost entirely forgotten is the extent of sabotage that the German government was carrying out in the United States at that time, including the explosion of Black Tom Island and numerous other sabotage schemes, some of which Sylvester Viereck himself was involved in. And in a somewhat amusing incident, he left his briefcase on a subway and the Secret Service confiscated it. And was able, they handed it to some of the newspapers, and those schemes were aired. So that's why I chose World War I. And not to expostulate too long here, the word revisionism is very interesting. I see three waves of revisionism after World War I, after World War II, and then again after the Cold War, in each case where America is blamed for having encircled a foreign power and its allies. But the revisionism that we see after World War I also leads, I think, ineluctably to the hardcore revisionism, Holocaust denial, that emerges after World War II and is a constituent element of the right post 1945.
Jacob, as you point out, Viereck plays a role in World War II, and Mencken does as well. I'm wondering, I have a couple of questions. One is, is it possible to disentangle kind of Mencken's satiric corpus from all the rest of this stuff, or is it all just intrinsic, as you were kind of suggesting, I think, in your remarks? But also, in World War II, the America First effort, in which Viereck and Mencken both play a role, is even bigger and broader, really, than it was in the First World War, because you've got other figures like Charles Lindbergh and Father Coughlin. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
I think Mencken is always going to be a disputed figure. He has his defenders, too, who argue that the racism and anti-Semitism were kinks and not a serious part of his personality or his writings. I came down on the other end, just given the virulence and the sustained nature of those writings, and above all, his sheer hostility to Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, he became a crank in the 1930s, as did many conservatives. I mean, one of the things that this working on this book fortified for me, and I'm not seeking out to denounce conservatism per se, but was that the movement in many ways has not changed, or factions within the conservative movement have not budged over almost 100 years. We see these same sentiments manifesting themselves today. That's why when I look back at the past, I do take them seriously. And it's not just eccentric fripperies that Mencken is tossing out, but actually pretty deeply held beliefs. And when he writes, you know, that maybe we can have an intellectual fascism in the United States, still, you know, to me, pretty chilling.
Yeah, but I guess maybe it's because I think of myself as a conservative. I mean, it seems to me they're not conservative at all. I mean, anybody who's playing with fascism is a revolutionary ideology. It's not a conservative ideology. I think it's pretty clear reading these people that they don't have a commitment to the Constitution, to, you know, kind of an ordered democracy, the kind of thing that various conservative icons in American history would have had. So I'm not saying this, you know, to be defensive about conservatives. I'm saying it to wonder if to really get at what's going on here, these are just people kind of reject the idea of a liberal democratic republic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you did have mainstream Republicans. I try to distinguish saying that this is not the conservative movement. It's a faction within, and you're right, they are the radical right. They are in fact not conservatives. The same thing holds true today. I don't think Trump is a conservative. I think he belongs to the radical right.
And it's also the case that a lot of, you know, I had the shock of recognition as I read your book, because a lot of conservatives have in the, you know, Trump era degenerated into sort of MAGA, you know, crankery. Whether it's Roger Kimball or others who, you know, have just become MAGA cranks.
It's very disappointing to me to see someone like Kimball, who is genuinely erudite, succumb to this either. And I don't know, you know, I don't want to speculate on motives, or maybe it's just the animus towards liberalism and what he sees as the cultural left. And that you have this brute force weapon that can be used to smash them. But in that sense, I would say Trump, you know, we get into the issue of, is what Trump is doing illegitimate within the context of the Republican Party? Maybe not. Maybe he's going back, as I kind of think, to an older, odious tradition in the GOP that has never been fully effaced, but was on the margins for much of the post-war, but now seems to have come roaring back.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I keep on reminding people the Republican Party was founded by Lincoln, who should be its patron, its patron saint. I guess I understand you don't want to speculate about Roger Kimmel, but I confess I'm baffled by that and by other people who I've known who've kind of gone into that pit. And, including, there's some kind of marginal figures like Michael Anton, who you you note in the book. But could I press you just talk a little bit about how does that happen, do you think? I mean, with Mencken, I understand the point of departure. He is from Baltimore, by the way, which, was a southern city and was pervaded by racism. I mean, in a profound way, for a very long time and is still wrestling with those issues.
As someone who was born at Johns Hopkins Hospital, Elliot, I resemble that remark. So,
I've taught at Johns Hopkins University for 34 years, and they are still wrestling with a lot of legacies. And I think, I'll be chauvinistic. I think they're doing as good a job as you can do. But there's a lot. There is undoubtedly a lot to wrestle with in the history of Hopkins, but also the history of Baltimore. So, but in any case, that I understand. The kind of current manifestation, I am baffled by, because it's not enough to say, well, it's all a result of the Iraq War. I don't buy that at all. None of these people had kids who were serving there, unlike some of the rest of us. I don't think that may have been a trigger for some of them, but there's something else that's going on here. And even somebody like Pat Buchanan, who you also mentioned, I think he was just always what he was. And we might want to talk about the kind of strand of kind of Catholic reactionary politics, which you reference also with people like, Deneen and Adrian Vermeule and people like that. But I am baffled by people like the Roger Kimballs.
And Father Coughlin during the interwar years.
Yeah.
Coughlin was not an intellectual. We're talking about intellectuals here, or those who would call themselves intellectuals. Often have a proclivity for extremism and for pushing ideas to their limit. And I think what Trump is espousing seems new and shiny and exciting, not like, especially among the younger generation of these conservatives or radical right, whichever term we want to use, they refer to zombie Reaganism. They disdain the old, what they regard as the old right. So there's also a mixture of opportunism. Have Kimball and Anton clambered onto this for personal reasons? I mean, Kimball was denouncing Trump initially as akin to Hitler in a beer hall. What prompted him to change his mind so radically? I don't think he's ever answered that question. What bothers me about these intellectuals are these lurches and sudden shifts. And I know we're going to talk about my own odyssey, as it were, but which I'm happy to do. But I am somewhat wary of radical intellectuals.
All of us have an odyssey. Jacob, you're not alone. I wanted to, before we get into the contemporary, although maybe it is tied to the contemporary, you talk a little bit about the efforts before World War II by the Roosevelt administration, also by some members of the Congress. I mean, you point out that the House Committee on Un-American Activities was actually stood up to deal not with the communist threat per se, but with the what some people called the Brown Scare, the threat from the, kind of right-wing lionization of Hitler and opposition to support to Britain in the war. You actually take the historian Leo Rebuffo to some task for arguing that there was a Brown Scare. You sort of suggest it was actually merited, that this was really a concern and a threat, that it wasn't just invented for political reasons. That does have a kind of contemporary ring, you know, for people who, the anti-antis who, you know, would you know, routinely accuse Elliot and me of suffering from, you know, Trump derangement syndrome. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that for our listeners and viewers, this notion of a brown scare and how that all played out.
Well, there clearly were plots again in the late 30s in Seattle and in Washington. One of the people I talk about, Lawrence Dennis, was involved in disseminating misinformation in the United States. He worked with the German embassy. He attended the Nuremberg rallies. There was Elizabeth Dilling, who is known as the female Führer in Germany, also attended the Nuremberg rallies and delivered anti-Semitic speeches in the United States to thousands of people. All of these people, she testified before Congress. All of these people that I talk, Merwin K. Hart, another anti-Semite, prominent New York businessman. The reason that I exhumed these figures is because they were on the front page of the New York Times in the late 30s. They were actively working to support Nazism, if not conspiring. And the Roosevelt administration took this seriously too. You had Attorney General Robert Jackson, who went after these people. The Interior Secretary Harold Ickes repeatedly denounced them, was also on the front page of the New York Times with his warnings. So this is not concocted out of thin air. This is not a fairy tale. And that is what bothered me a little bit. One of the critics in the American Conservative acted like, well, why is Heilbrunn focusing on these obscure figures? At the time, they were not obscure, and it's important not to write them out of history.
Well, I think that's a, you know, that's a critical point. One thing people forget is in 1940, the main war plan, which was, you know, people were focused on most, was deploying the United States Army to Brazil to prevent the Germans from leaping across from Dakar. You know, you had the FBI running all over Latin America. I mean, the idea that there was a serious, you know, Nazi threat to the United States was real. But, and closer to home, you had things like that giant Madison
Square Garden rally.
Yeah, you had that. You had that rally. You had, you know, you had marches. I mean, Boston's my hometown, and I remember as my wife showing me some pictures of these marches in Boston, and there are, you know, Nazi flags out there. I wonder, in a way, reverting a little bit to the previous part of the conversation, you know, is part of this story here that actually the genuinely liberal tradition in the United States, if that's how we want to characterize it, is weaker than we might think, that you either get, you get this kind of stuff, and you get, then you have a progressive or kind of left impulse. And, you know, FDR was turning a lot of things upside down, as was Teddy Roosevelt in his time. And it's, I mean, you know, I think of my own intellectual heroes, then the top of the list would be Raymond Aron and Isaiah Berlin. Maybe it's not an accident that neither of them are Americans.
That's a good point. Part of what we view as the, what Richard Hofstadter called the liberal tradition, right, is the American liberal, the political tradition, is dependent on what happens today. Because these things go back, you know, was the right, in fact, more powerful all along than we assumed? Some of that is going to depend on what happens in this election. You know, obviously, we want to avoid reading too much back into history, constructing a straight line. But I do think we are inevitably influenced by what happens today. But yeah, it is worrisome. I mean, Roosevelt had to fight. None of this was inevitable, that we were going to enter World War II. In fact, we barely did. Colonel McCormick was ranting against Roosevelt. What are you doing to save your country? He was on the front page of his 30 days to the election. I mean, in 1936, it's constant. And Lend-Lease, you know, Roosevelt had to fight to get that through. Again, none of this is inevitable. And the right, as I show in my book, in 1944 is already meeting to try and roll back the not just the New Deal, but the foreign policy that emerges after that's going to emerge after World War II. So the anti-liberal tradition probably is stronger than we acknowledged.
So, you know, this is one of the reasons why, and I think Eric may want to chime in on this. I have a somewhat gentler view of Bill Buckley than you do. I think your characterization of his positions in the 40s, he was an America Firster as a college student. In the 50s and 60s, there's a lot of stuff there that is reprehensible. But I think you also have to say that he was a very important figure in marginalizing a lot of this radical right impulse. And that is how I would characterize it rather than conservative. And he did it at some cost to personal friendships. You know, you mentioned Brent Bozell, who he had been very close to. Joe Sobrin is another. Pat Buchanan is a third. And you know, between him and then Eisenhower, of course, you know, beating out Taft, I wonder if people like, at least me, kind of thought, okay, well, you know, the Republican Party had gone through all that. The good guys kind of marginalized these characters and they've gone back underground. And, you know, the problem is that they're kind of like the locusts who show up every 17 years. Yeah, they're underground. They're multiplying and breeding and then boom, they're back. I know. Actually, Eric, you should chime in before we get a more considered view.
No, I quite agree, Elliot. I mean, I think Buckley played an important role in excising the Birchers and the Klan. And, you know, Jacob does talk about his firing Joe Sobran, that episode over anti-Semitism at the time of the first Gulf War. So I quite agree with you. I mean, I agree with Jacob's characterization about his pretty loathsome support for Buckley or for McCarthy, excuse me, in the 50s and his lifelong admiration for, you know, General Franco. But I do think his legacy is more complicated.
Well, I wasn't trying to deliver a denunciation of Buckley, who I also met and had lunch with and enjoyed speaking with. I don't think Bill Buckley was an anti-Semite. I think L. Brent Bozell was the far more radical version of Bill Buckley and his mentor, Wilmer Kendall, at Yale. And Bozell led the first violent protest against an abortion clinic in Washington, D.C. in 1970 and was a manic depressive. Buckley was much more modulated. I think it's true his views did change, but, you know, there are these historical debates. You know, this younger generation of historians takes a more critical eye on the Bircher thing, saying that he was pushed into it, that he was reluctant and so forth. I didn't really get into that because I was primarily looking at Buckley's defenses of apartheid and of his admiration for Pinochet and his fervor for McCarthy, which he maintained to the end of his life. So, you know, I think Buckley had a good side and a bad side. I guess that's the way I look at it.
You know, I think that's right, but I think I would also say he changed. He early in his life, he was unquestionably racist. And he was also anti-Semitic. And he was, I mean, I had long conversations with him about it. And he was upfront that he had changed. I mean, what I find depressing about, you know, some of the figures that you talk about and others that you could have talked about in the contemporary scene, they haven't changed. And I very much doubt that J.D. Vance, take a politician who's smart, I mean, he's certainly no idiot. I doubt very much that he'll kind of, you know, drift to some sort of moderate center. I don't think that's likely to happen. I can't resist using this as an opportunity to get you to talk a little bit about your own journey, if you feel you've been on one. You haven't. I suspect most of our listeners will know, but probably not all. I mean, there you are at the National Interest, which founded by Irving Kristol. For the record, I was on the founding board of the magazine, which took a very different turn, I think, once Dimitri Symes, who you talk about, who I had very little time for, took over. And, you know, is this a particularly interesting vantage point from which to write about these people, or is it difficult, or have your views changed? I'm just curious.
No, I don't think it was difficult at all. And it was a good vantage point because I met many, many of these people. I mean, I actually began my career, such as it is, as an assistant editor at the National Interest in 1989, with the first issue being The End of History, when Owen Harries was the editor and Irving was the publisher. And I thought that the journal at that time exemplified a broad range of views. You had centrist Democrats like Stephen Solarts writing for it, Pat Moynihan, Sam Huntington was a frequent contributor, and then you had neoconservatives as well. So that, and then I went to work for the New Republic, which was probably a little bit to the left of the National Interest, but not much. And again, which featured a wide range of opinions. My own views have always been, it sounds a little antiquated, but I was a youth, teenage anti-communist. And my views have not really shifted very much from those views. That's why I take such a dim view now of what is taking place between Russia and Ukraine. And I suppose ultimately it is rooted as it is with, as I pointed out in my book on neoconservatives, in my own family history with experiences with Nazi Germany, that many of my ancestors were murdered in the death camps there. So I have this is all living history for me. So yes, I worked with Dmitry Symes, who I did learn some things from him, could be quite intelligent and also had, again, a dark side. It brought me into contact with realists and made me much more familiar with the tradition. And I felt in some ways more comfortable with Henry Kissinger's more classical view of realism or Sam Huntington than I do with the current crop, which purports to espouse realism. But in fact, it is isolationism and in some cases, even pro-Putin. And that is the point that I tried to make in the book, that we use this term isolationist for the figures in the late 30s and early 40s. In fact, a lot of them were not isolationists. They were not neutral. They were pro-Nazi Germany and pro-Mussolini's Italy.
Yeah, one of the things about Dmitry's fall from grace now, I mean, he finds himself as the co-host of a propaganda show on Russian television with Vyacheslav Nikanov, who is Molotov's grandson. I mean, it's sort of, you know, incredibly ironic that this, you know, person who was a, you know, son of a prominent, you know, Russian dissident in the Soviet era is now, you know, co-hosting, you know, a Stalinoid propaganda show with Stalin's grandson.
Actually, both the parents, his mother was a well-known human rights lawyer and his father wrote a denunciation of the nomenklatura. I talk about all this in the introduction to my book. This is again getting into psychological speculation, but I wonder to what extent it is an Oedipal rebellion against the parents, but primarily I think he sees the liberals that he encountered in Russia in the 60s and then in the 90s as weak and feckless, and approaches it from a conservative, if not reactionary, perspective.
Well, I was going to say, I think you're putting your finger on something. There's an admiration of strength. And it's the kind of thing that Churchill saw very early on, I believe, in Nazi Germany, and you reacted against it. But, you know, I'm thinking about realists. I mean, I'm thinking about John Mearsheimer, with whom I've crossed swords on more than one occasion, you know, enjoying visits with Viktor Orban and being very chummy with him, going to Valdai and meeting with Putin, making excuses for him. And I quite agree with you. This is not realism. I probably have more issues with Kissinger. Eric and I have kind of gone back on the forth in this, but I mean, obviously he's well within a certain kind of mainstream. But with something like Mearsheimer, there's a kind of admiration of a certain type of strongman. And it's, again, I'll just say, I don't think it's conservative. I think it's We misunderstand it if we think it's conservative. It is a kind of vaunting of power.
Yeah, I mean, none of these guys can convince me that a diminution of American power abroad constitutes realism. Abandoning NATO? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I agree. Jacob, I wanted to raise one other thinker who you touch on in the book who doesn't fit in completely with some of the others, and that's Jean Kirkpatrick. You know, and I should stipulate that as a former special assistant of George Shultz's, so I was, you know, on, you know, the other side of several, you know, internal debates with her in the Reagan administration. You take on her very famous commentary article about dictatorships and double standards. And the argument she made at the time was that it was okay for the United States to support certain kinds of authoritarian regimes, particularly like Pinochet in Chile, but others in Latin America, because those regimes, unlike totalitarian regimes, didn't try and actually change individuals. They didn't try and create a new Soviet man the way the Soviet Union did. And therefore, they were reformable and they could be changed, whereas totalitarianism was immutable. It's certainly clear in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union that even totalitarian regimes are not immutable. They can, collapse of their own weight. But it's also the case that, you know, she wasn't 100% wrong in the sense that South Korea, Taiwan, which were authoritarian regimes at the time she wrote in the 70s, have emerged as flourishing, vibrant, you know, democracies. So what is your take there on her? And she doesn't also come out of a conservative Republican right-wing tradition. She comes out of a liberal democratic tradition.
Right. So it is interesting that Pat Buchanan wrote a piece in the American Conservative called The One Good Neocon. It was Jean Kirkpatrick. Because if you recall, or you may not recall, but I was there, so I remember all this. In 1990, she wrote a piece for the National Interest. Owen Harries had commissioned this symposium about what is America's purpose. And she basically said, come home, America. She said, we've done our bit. It's time to focus on the domestic front. Yeah. The reason I did talk about the dictatorships and double standards article, which incidentally, Bob Kagan denounced in commentary years later. Yes. And I thought that she went, that the article was too much of an apology for right-wing regimes in Central America. And one of the things that I tried to do in the book, perhaps not entirely successful, is distinguish between support for a right-wing regime and avidity for it. And as I looked at her record, particularly in the case of the Argentine junta, I mean, my God, she supported their invasion of the Falklands and worked overtime to try and sabotage the British in Washington. And she was a lone wolf on that in the Reagan administration. It just seemed to me, and I knew her pretty well. And I think it seemed to me that at the time she was way too receptive to these right-wing regimes. She is the most controversial choice in my mind now that I've thought about it more. And that is a frequent criticism that is leveled, that she is a bit of an outlier in the book as well. But I suppose the defense would be that in some ways, these distinctions are a little artificial, and that her defense of these regimes did in fact coincide more with Buchanan and company than perhaps many would like to acknowledge.
I think that's it's a very nice distinction between, I think, what you saw with Kissinger. Okay, he's going to support Pinochet over Allende, and it's a kind of a very cold-blooded geopolitical calculation. And you know what you describe as avidity. I'm whether it applies to Jean Kirkpatrick, I'm not sure. I haven't really. I knew her. I didn't know her that well, and I don't think I could make that sort of judgment. But I think there is a distinction there, and it gets to the heart of what I find most interesting about the book, which is it keeps on posing to me the question: okay, well, where does this come from? What triggers it? And is there anything that can eventually break it? I mean, there were. There, you know, There's been a what Jean-François Revel called a totalitarian temptation on the left as well as on the right. There are these kind of break moments in history where they don't completely go away, but you know, after a certain point, the American left at least nominally breaks with Stalin. You know, for sure, World War II did kind of give a blow to that kind of authoritarian isolationism, or however we're going to characterize it. So I guess, you know, there maybe if you could address either or both sides of that. First, are there things that go on in the culture that trigger this? I tend to think there are. I mean, as long as I have the floor, I'll rant and rave a little bit. I think, you know, with people like Mencken and so on, I think a lot of this has to do with the society undergoing a lot of change, with a lot of immigrants and that they feel very uncomfortable with, the sort of displacement of traditional elites. I think that's why you have so many Harvard and Yale graduates in your rogues gallery. And I think now some of this...
That is anxiety.
Yeah. And I think now some of this is reaction to cultural stuff that, you know, I tend to think has gone way too far. But in any case, I think those are some of the triggers for it. The more interesting question in some ways for me is, will there be events that will break this, or not break it, but, you know, diminish it, you know, drive the locusts back underground for a while?
I agree with you. I mean, if you look at the left, it's both the left and the right. It's the 1930s. You have on the right, you have the admiration for Hitler and Mussolini and Franco. And then on the left, you have the adoration of Stalin at the time of the height of the great purges. You know, when the system is at its most demonic, it is hailed as being the most virtuous. Then in the 1960s, again, of course, you have it on the left, the admiration for Mao's China during the Cultural Revolution, the Viet Cong, the Ho Chi Minh. I mean, there's a long history for both the left and the right. I think it's the idea that there's this utopia abroad that can be transplanted back to America. If only we can absolve and wash away our sins on the domestic front. And that is what Mr. Trump is promising. He is promising, you know, we haven't really talked about him, but he is promising in his Time magazine interview again today, a radical change in the way the United States functions. And I actually fully believe him. I think because of his megalomania, he wants to go down as a great president. And the only way that he can do that is to try and utterly transform America. And the easiest place to do that is in foreign policy, because there he'll have a free hand. I don't know if I've answered your question adequately, but that's where I've ended up.
It's a beginning, but Eric is going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree with you, Jacob. You know, the late Peter Gay was one of the historians I learned from at Yale when I was a graduate student. He used to talk about the higher naivete, which is that if someone tells you something over and over again, you know, in print, you know, unless you have some evidence to disbelieve it, you probably should take them, you know, at their word. And I am inclined to do that. I, you know, we're beginning to get short on time, and I do want to ask you, because I've written a bit about the America Firsters in the 30s as well, not as at great length or with as much sophistication as you have, but I've made the argument that because of Father Coughlin, because of Mencken and others, Lindbergh, that America First in the 30s and early 40s became inextricably tied up with anti-Semitism. And when you look at its current manifestation, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about the Rothschilds and space lasers and Nick Fuentes dining with the president and, you know, creating an America First pack, it seems like this thing is basically inextricably tied up with anti-Semitism, perhaps in part because it frequently seeks to explain international events with convoluted conspiracy theories. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, that definitely has been the case, which is why I mean, I point it, the after 1945, the latest scholarship shows that the conservative movement or the right wing served as a dress rehearsal for the Holocaust denial that emerged later in the United States with, you know, with figures like Harry Elmer Barnes. I've been looking, I mean, it didn't shock me that Trump had dinner with Nick Fuentes. I would not be surprised if anti-Semitism became more prominent on the right and more accepted. However, I do feel obliged to note in this context and trying to answer Elliot's previous question further, I remain an optimist. I do not think that what Trump is peddling is in marketing is a winning message. I remain convinced that this is a losing argument, but I wrote the book as a warning of what can happen when you have a recrudescence of these beliefs and arguments.
You know, for what it's worth, I agree with you. I mean, we can get into the question of Trump's political prospects if we want, but I think it's, you're right to be optimistic. Can we return to anti-Semitism for a moment? So we're seeing an explosion of it right now. I think it's fair to say we're not seeing it on the right. We're seeing it on the left. It is, of course, triggered to some extent by the Israel-Hamas. It is triggered by the Israel-Hamas war, but there's a kind of a, to my mind at any rate, a depth and an extent and a virulence which indicates to me something deeper, this time on the left. Do you see it that way? I mean, I know if this is a subject you care about and you've written about, and I'd be curious to hear your views.
Well, obviously the left has never been exempt from these impulses in the late 60s. In fact, this is what led in many ways to the rise of the neoconservative movement. I'm careful about hurling the charge anti-Semitism because it gets flung about so much. But clearly, if you look at what is taking place on American college campuses, there are bad actors out there, people, I think, who are going to need to be suspended or expelled from these institutions. It sounds like it's moving out of control.
I do have one data point to the earlier conversation, Jacob, your point that this is a losing message, and Elliot, your assent to that. I note that Ann Carney has a piece in the New York Times today about members of Congress in the Republican conference who went back to their districts expecting that they were going to be excoriated for having voted for this is the 101 who voted for the supplemental. And that, of course, was what Marjorie Taylor Greene was counting on to power her motion to vacate against Speaker Johnson. And lo and behold, most of those members, not all, but most of them have gone back and been, gone to town halls and been congratulated by people for doing the right thing, which is a kind of encouraging sign, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, what Elliot called it a rogues gallery. I mean, this is vile stuff that I've chronicled. And I would be stupefied if a majority of Americans supported the nostrums that Trump is invoking. Again, you know what he's talking about in his Time magazine interview today. I would be very surprised if that garners a majority of votes.
I hope that's right. And from your lips, I hope that goes to God's ears. So.
Or at least to the voters.
At least to voters' ears.
Thanks.
Our guest today has been Jacob Halbrin, the author of America Last, The Right Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Jacob, it's been a pleasure having you on. I hope a lot of our listeners will go out and get your book and read it. There's a lot to be learned here.
Hear, hear.
Thank you.